Hello and welcome to the Spectator podcast. I'm Freddie Gray. On today's episode, we'll be discussing the relationship between Islam and violence, asking why Brexit has been the dog that hasn't barked in this election, and talking about the need for darkness. First up, following another terrorist attack in London this weekend, Tom Holland says that Islamist terror comes from a long tradition of brutal supremacism within the Muslim faith. He joins us now with Christopher de Belleg, author of The Islamic Enlightenment. Tom, in your cover piece this week, you say that Theresa May says that Islamic violence is a perversion of the Islamic faith, and you argue that that's actually wrong. Can you explain to us how that's wrong?
I think that although we are now a multi-faith, multicultural society, we do nevertheless have a single state faith, and that faith is one that believes that religions are in their essence peaceful, liberal and tolerant, because that's what the vast majority of people in this country, Christian, Muslim, Jewish, whoever, and indeed agnostic or atheist, tend to be. But to imagine that all religions are necessarily pacific, to imagine that all religions can be reduced to the kind of platitudes that you hear on Thought for the Day is, I think, hugely over-optimistic. And unless we recognise that there are strains within Islam that absolutely foster violence, just as there are strains that foster peace, then we're not going to be able to deal, I think, adequately with the terror threat that we're currently seeing.
You talk about recognising the problem. What happens after we recognise the problem? What do we do once we've recognised that there is a connection between Islam and violence?
I'm in no way saying that this is a panacea, and it may be that there is no ready solution. But I think that essentially what is going on in global Islam is, in a sense, a civil war. And I remember speaking to a journalist in Cairo, who was himself a Muslim, who said that essentially the division in the Islamic world at the moment is between those who believe themselves to be superior to non-Muslims by virtue of being Muslim and those who don't. And essentially that is a tension bred of the impact of the Enlightenment and of Western notions of human rights on Islam. And where that civil war goes, we don't know. I mean, it's the nature of civil wars, of course, that they are inherently vociferous, and also that they tend to generate a lot of collateral damage. And unfortunately, people in Borough Market, as in Manchester and on Westminster Bridge, are collateral damage, I think, in that ongoing civil war.
Christopher, do you think that's right? British or Western victims of terror attacks, just collateral damage in a war between Sunni and Shia Islam, or between...
Well, it's not Sunni and Shia, I must say that.
Progressive modern Islam and reactionary violent Islam.
I think there's been a... Tom speaks of strains within Islam as he does of strains within other religions. I think that's right. But I think it's also right to recognise that there have been strains, many strains within Islam since its inception. Indeed, the idea of Islam as a unified body of thought is relatively recent. Mm. If you look at really one of the most dominant strains, which is Sufi Islam, then you will find that there is really nothing that constrains or pushes people towards violence. And that is something that is entirely absent from the discussion of Islam that we hear about nowadays. There is clearly a tension between a strain within Islam that says we are the best and we came last, and it is our manifest destiny to supersede every other faith tradition on earth, which is, I think, practiced by a very, very small minority of people, and a great panoply of other thoughts and traditions and ideas that exist. It is very soon to be the largest faith community, the largest religion in the world. So it cannot be reduced to a simple dichotomy between
the enlightened West.
And I think the idea that we are collateral damage is true to an extent, but that also, I think it downplays the effect of certain historical events on Muslim communities in this country. And whether it be events in their own countries, or the countries from which they originally sprung, or whether it be the consequences of integration and multiculturalism in this country and the problems that have ensued from that. So it's a big question.
It's obviously a big question, but nonetheless, don't deny that Islamism is responsible for more terrorist violence than any religion in the world at the moment. So it is a problem within Islam.
It's certainly a problem within Islam. I have no problem in saying that Islam contains the seeds for immense violence. The texts are there, just as the texts that push people towards immense acts of love and fraternity also exist. It is a question of interpretation, as it was in the interpretation of Christianity that led people to commit the Srebrenica massacre or the Spanish Inquisition. Religions, if you look at it from a historical or an agnostic point of view, are essentially human productions, and they contain within them the potential for all forms of behaviour, all forms of human behaviour, ranging from the wonderful to the vile.
Tom, do you think by sort of singling it out as a strain within Islam and that hasn't gone through an enlightenment process, you're in danger of tarring the Islamic faith?
No, I think I'm acknowledging that there are faith traditions and civilizations and cultures that can't readily be integrated into a 21st century liberal, secular tradition bred of the very specific cultural circumstances that we have in Britain. And I think it's a kind of a conceit to imagine that they can be. Historically, Christendom and the world of Islam have been the two civilizations that have seen themselves as potentially universal. Both believe that the world would be better for being subordinated to their values. And there is a sense in which the modern West, with its notions of universal, so-called universal human rights, is the heir of that universalizing Christian mission. And inevitably, when you have two belief systems, two civilizations, both of them believe that they should be universal, the potential for conflict is inevitable. And I think that what's remarkable actually is not the degree of tension that we have between the two tectonic plates rubbing together, but how little there is considering the rival aspirations that both have.
You talk about the connection between Christianity and the Enlightenment. You talk also about in your piece about the martyrs on London Bridge, but they were not martyrs who themselves killed in the act of dying of martyrdom. Do you think perhaps you're putting too much on the Enlightenment in Christianity's progress towards non-violence?
Thomas More notoriously was not keen on Protestant heretics.
He did quite a lot of killing himself. Yeah, not himself.
And of course, after Henry VIII's reign, Mary Tudor came in and burnt large numbers of Protestants. So, by and large, if you feel if you feel about a religious point of view strongly enough to die for it, there is a sense perhaps in which the potential there that you might end up feeling strongly enough to kill for it as well. I'm not saying that's a hard and fast rule, but where religion becomes a matter of life and death, the potential for the martyred to martyr is, I think, always there.
But I think you seem to be saying that Protestantism had the enlightening effect on Christianity. And that doesn't quite work with Sunni and Shia Islam, does it, Christopher?
Well, I think the idea of two universalising ideologies somehow in conflict with each other is partly convincing and is very interesting. I think it should be tempered by a realization that before the sense of a centralized state apparatus appropriating religion across the Western world and across the Islamic world came to be very dominant, there was an infinite number of variations. And you only have to read the travel reports of people who went through the Balkans in the 19th century to find that in every single village where Jew, Muslim and Christian coexisted, there was an interchange between the faiths, and people used to visit each other's shrines, and people used to go and make intercessions and demand intercession from a particular saint or a particular shrine that belonged to a religion that wasn't officially their own. So there was this enormous fluidity. Mm. That fluidity has, I regret to say, more or less disappeared now. It is far more difficult to occupy that blurry space between religious faiths. And I think where this comes to our situation is it is now very difficult to inhabit this country believing that your faith is something that is going to guide and dominate your existence and dominate you in terms of a way of life, and at the same time fulfill your duties to what is becoming in the mainstream a highly aggressively secularized state. It is not so much that Muslims haven't got with the program of a secularized state. It is that the secularized state has outstripped and it has I think, effectively destroyed Christianity in this country. So if Muslims say, well, we could go along that route, but what would that eventually mean? It would mean giving up our religion, and it would mean clinging on to Islam purely and in some kind of vestigial sense, in the way that most Christians attach themselves to Christianity, which is to say, hardly at all.
So you see it as a reaction to aggressive secularism?
I don't think that, I wouldn't say that what's happening on in terms of the terrorist activities are a reaction to aggressive secularism. I think that a bedrock or an environment of hostility towards organized religion has been part of the problem. But I also think that there is a huge number of other things that play into the mind of a young man who is going to oscillate wildly from some kind of nationalist feeling towards his country, some kind of hedonistic feeling. We see a lot of these guys have oscillated from extreme hedonistic behaviour and then into extreme Islamist behaviour.
Reverting to identity. Yeah.
It's partly reverting to identity, but it's also outstripping the identity of their parents, because their parents are inevitably much more traditional, much more cautious, and completely disavow and don't recognise the religion in their children. And I think that there is a kind of mental malaise, there is a psychological malaise at work here that means that people latch on to a perverted ideology as a form of ultimate expression. And we find it particularly in France, and a lot of sociologists have done work on this subject, and they find that Islam, of course, is part of the problem in that its texts do contain the potential for violence, but overwhelmingly the problem is one of history, it is one of psychology, and it is one of young men who suffer from great internal problems.
Tom, what do you think about that?
Well, I'm not convinced that religion can be so conveniently separated from social cultural factors. Religion, like everything else, is a cultural phenomenon. And the question of whether, you know, the radicals are being Islamized or Islam is being radicalized, as it's been put by French theorists, in a sense, I think it's an academic question. There seems to me absolutely no doubt that what is essentially motivating the killers, the bombers in Britain, is a kind of weird mix of self-pity and supremacism. They resent the fact, I think, that, you know, they feel clearly probably deracinated, alienated from mainstream society, and the appeal of an ideology that says God wants you to rule the world. God wants you to be his stormtrooper. God wants you to seize the initiative. I can absolutely see how that would give meaning to somebody who may otherwise be feeling humiliated and downtrodden. Now, is that a product of religion? Is that a product of social circumstance? Is that a product of nationalist alienation? It's probably a mix of all those things. But the lightning rod is, at the moment, the kind of dignity and potency that Islam can give these people, I think.
That was Tom Holland and Christopher de Belleg. Hello, I'm Sam Leith, literary editor of The Spectator, and I present the weekly books podcast, at which you'll hear lively discussions from the best and most interesting critics and writers and authors out there, from Charlotte Rampling to Daniel Dennett, all the way past to Michael Morpurgo. I very much hope you'll give us a try. Just search for Spectator Books on the iTunes store. Next, we turn our attention for the last time to the election campaign. In his column this week, James Forsyth says that the failure of the Remain dog to bark in this election is surprising. So why haven't the 48%ers imposed themselves on this election? To discuss, James joins us with Polly Toynbee, the Guardian columnist and author of Dismembered, How the Attack on the State Harms Us All. James, I think the gist of your column this week is that this election has been good for Brexit, but bad for May. Is that a fair summary of what you're saying?
I think that we have to wait for the result to tell what it is for Theresa May, but I think even now it is clear that it has been good for Brexit. I think if you talk to lots of politicians on the Leave side in the days after the referendum, they were very worried about a general election. They thought that they might have victory snatched from them. Instead, the legitimacy of Brexit is going to be enhanced by this election. It will have not only the backing of a referendum, but a general election too. The House of Lords will have no grounds on which to slow things down, because leaving both the single market and the customs union are Tory manifesto commitments. You know, the House of Lords therefore cannot block it. So I think that Brexit has definitely emerged strengthened from this process. I think there is now no chance of it not happening.
Polly, what's happened to the 48%ers? Where have they gone?
They've given up to some extent. It's going to happen. It would be undemocratic. It was the will of the people. Only fairly militant pro-Europeans deny that. But nobody thinks it's the end of the game. This is the beginning of the game. The process hasn't begun. And it's all very well for you to say, well, the House of Lords can't block leaving. That's true. But there are going to be myriad different decisions to be made along the way. And all of it will be out of the open. 27 countries will be telling exactly what's happening in the negotiations. All of it will be up for a big fight as to what it really means. How close in can you still stay to the single market? How much do we have to pay? How much is worth paying in the divorce settlement? I mean, Timothy Garton-Ash has written a piece in The Guardian today saying that when he talks, his very good contacts across Europe, talks to the main negotiators, they think there is a very, very high chance indeed that there will be no deal, that the thing will break down over the divorce settlement right at the start.
I think when you look at this, I think there will definitely be... I think the British side will overlearn the lessons of Cameron's failure, which was the failure to ever be prepared to walk away, and will perhaps be too prepared to walk away. I think there will certainly be several instances when we all think the talks have collapsed, but I don't think they actually will. I think in the end there will be a deal reached. Where I completely agree with Polly is that the nature of Brexit has not been settled by this election. The kind of country we are going to be after Brexit. Now, Britain is leaving the single market in Theresa May's thinking, I think, because Britain can't accept free movement. There is a massive question about what leaving the single market means. If we leave the single market but shadow the single market's regulatory regime, that would massively reduce the impact of leaving. But I think that would also mean that you couldn't take advantage of the opportunities of Brexit. I think one of the opportunities of Brexit is to get out from under the single market regulatory regime to enable us to do different things. You know, for example, outside the clinical trials directive, it would be possible for this country to be home to kind of really innovative, groundbreaking medical research on things like stem cells, which you cannot do within the European legal setting. So I think the question is, do we seize those opportunities or not? I mean, that is going to be one of the big things. And
Polly, you presumably think those opportunities are pie in the sky.
I think that's where your feet leave the ground and you actually have drifted off into the realms of utter fantasy. I mean, the idea that, never mind anybody else, the idea that the British will agree to breaking any of our regulations, you know, we're going to let American beef full of penicillin and chemicals into our food chain, or that we are going to have medicines that don't stick with the European directives, which are quite strict. The idea that, you know, even the Daily Mail is going to tolerate any less safety in our regulations on almost anything, it's just not going to happen. It isn't going to be that simple.
I mean, this is going to be one of the great political debates of the next few years, you know, which is, you know, are we prepared to eat chicken washed in chlorine? I mean, I lived in America for 4 years, probably might say that explains some of my odd views. I probably ate quite a lot of chlorinated chicken, but we wash our lettuce in chlorine. I don't see what the difference between lettuce and chlorine is and chlorinated chicken. I wouldn't mind the hormone-injected beef. I might be a bit taller than I am if I'd eaten it. I think this is going to be a really big question about free trade, and I think it's going to come, for the Tory party, it's going to come very quickly. Because if you look at the first three countries that I think are likely to do trade deals with the UK post-Brexit, they're Australia, New Zealand and Canada, which all have large agricultural sectors. They will want a big reduction in agricultural tariffs to be part of that deal, which is obviously going to open up the British farming industry, which is traditionally a Tory-backing industry, to more global competition.
They're already beginning to clock it. Suddenly, you're hearing farmers who were very Brexity and never liked the CAP suddenly realising what's going to hit them in terms of competition and in terms of what they may not get instead of the CAP. There's no reason to think they're going to be compensated down to the last penny for huge subsidies they've had up until now. I mean, that's just one small area.
Cheaper food would be a good thing, surely.
I think there will be outcry if it's cheaper food or at lower health standards. And you know, I'm not going to argue the technicalities of whether chlorine is good or bad for you. I just don't think it will wash with the most of the public. They will be hysterical. I mean, I was not particularly against GM foods, but people didn't like it.
I don't want to get too much into food types. But Polly, what you were saying about how the character of the Brexit debate may sort of change in its next phase after this election, wouldn't you think that it is in the British character, though, to become more resolute about something like this as the negotiations start? That may not be a good thing, but that's just how the British are.
In principle and in broad brush, yes. But when we come down to these specific sectors and people are thinking about a whole lot of things that will affect them, where they live, all kinds of things to do with their work, their region, their industry, I think suddenly there's going to be a lot more difficulty about, well, we wanted it, but we didn't want this. We wanted it, but we didn't want that. Oh, we didn't want this to happen. And when they see the economy is already, you know, much weakened, finally it's fed through into inflation, that people's wages are falling below inflation, and that's as a direct result of the devaluation of the pound. When more of those things feed through to people, I mean, as Philip Hammond said, people didn't vote to be poorer. And at some point, they're going to have to face up to that and ask, what's worth it? You know, how far should we come out of Europe? For what price?
And perhaps, James, that's where May has suffered because of this election, or May's Brexit position has suffered, in that people don't have the confidence in her that they would have done beforehand.
I think that she, politically, before she went to the country, there was an assumption that she would sweep all before her. She would win a big three-figure majority. Look, we don't know the result now, but I think a majority of 80 is probably more likely than a majority of 120, for example. So, yeah, to that extent, she's weakened. I think one of the odd things about this election campaign, though, is the lack of enthusiasm for the Liberal Democrats. At the start of it, one of the things I thought would happen is that the Lib Dem vote share would go up significantly and they would more than double the number of seats they'd have. And I thought that, you know, in media terms, I thought by the end of the election, you'd have the Remain supporting media, you know, the Guardian, the likes, really kind of saying people to vote Liberal Democrat. The fact that the Liberal Democrats, with a promise of a second referendum in which they would campaign to remain, have failed to have any cut through, I think,
actually,
is quite telling.
That was their error. They had 48% of people, but when they said another referendum, I think that was the point at which people suddenly choked and said, hang on a minute, we've only just had one referendum, don't talk about another. And even though they're talking about a referendum, which you didn't make plain in your piece, on a quite different basis, it wasn't, do we not come out? It was, do we accept these terms or do we send you back to say these terms are not acceptable? Nevertheless, I think the very idea of ever holding another referendum in this country is a terrible mistake, and I think a lot of people think it. So if they'd just gone for, we want to stay in, we want the best possible deal, in as close as we can, you know that we're the most pro-European, I think they would have done better.
But I think one of the things that is a paradox of British politics at the moment is, in this election campaign, I think the debate has moved to the left. If you look at the fact that you now have a Tory party that wants to cap energy prices, that talks in quite hostile terms about business, there's definitely, this is, I think Theresa May offers a kind of bridge back to kind of Ted Heath's Tory party rather than being a kind of a Thatcherite. Yet, paradoxically, I think Brexit has to shift the British economic model structurally to the right. Because if you are going to leave the single market, the way that you compensate for that is by going to a lower tax, lower regulation model. That is the way that you are going to succeed economically. So I think there's going to be one of the very interesting things to watch play out in British politics over the next 10, 20 years, is that tension.
To be a low tax, a tax haven, offshore tax haven.
There's a
haven.
Difference between being low tax and being a tax haven.
Well,
I think it
goes together as a package. And low regulation, come here and you can avoid all of the irksome stuff that makes Europe the most civilised place in the world. You can avoid all that. You know, we'll do away with rules. You can hide your money here. You know, we'll become disreputable.
That's not what the May's manifesto was.
It's not what she says, but it's
aimed at.
It's what you're implying. If you think the alternative, it's not what she said, it's what you're implying. What's interesting about what she said, let me just make this point. You said, oh, she's going back to a sort of Heathite era. You know politicians by the money they spend. You know them by their budgets. We've had her first budget, and her first budget is exactly on the same trajectory as George Osborne's. And it says in the Red Book that the aim is to get the size of the state down to 35%. Now, there is nothing Heathite about that. This is pure Thatcherism. It's much further than Thatcher herself ever dared go or expected to go.
But you might also point out that, according to the IFS, under the Tories, the tax burden is going to hit the highest level in 30-odd years. And they push back deficit reduction until 2025. You know, it's not, you know, even if the Tories win a landslide majority, they will not balance the books in the next parliament. I think in a way you can say that you know politicians by what they do, and she doesn't appear to be an economic radical in that sense.
But the cuts have gone ahead. 12 billion, she's gone ahead with 12 billion from the very jams, the just about managing families. She's taken that money off them. All of the charts show that it's the poorer half of the population that is going to suffer. suffer most from her plans that has proceeded within her budget, as did Cameron in the beginning. She walks one way and talks another.
But I mean, look, I think you can argue about what she is doing, but I think it is hard to argue that she is a low tax, small state radical Tory. I mean, she doesn't appear to mean to be in that tradition at all. And her policies, you know, pushing back deficit reduction until 2025, the way she talks about increased state provision in all sorts of areas, doesn't strike me as an example of that.
And go back to the theme of your column, Polly, do you think she will be weaker now in Brexit negotiations, assuming she wins?
I don't know how much it'll affect the Brexit negotiations. I think they will have noticed a sudden U-turn and that a puff of wind, but that will probably alarm them because they won't know that she can stick at whatever she says she's going to do in a negotiation. Across the table, you want to know where somebody stands. I think what she's lost is a credibility of whether she is really a good leader, whether she is really strong, whether she has a political imagination, whether she has agility and flexibility. And none of those things have been on display during the election.
Do you think Corbyn has gained a credibility that he didn't have before?
Well, astonishingly, he has. He's come across as a sort of cheerful, grandfatherly figure. If only he could leave his enormous backstory baggage behind. If somebody came at him afresh, he's done very well indeed, much better than I thought he would do. He started off with a kind of scratchy tetchiness. That's all gone. His demeanour has been very good, and he seems to have been enjoying himself. After all, campaigning is what he does best.
I mean, Polly is totally right about the tetchiness point. I always thought that Jeremy Corbyn's problem in a general election campaign is that in every local election campaign we've seen under his leadership, he's lost his temper several times, and he's come across as a kind of irritable, crotchety figure. In this campaign, I think he's only come close to losing his temper once, and that was when he got the kind of 17th question on Trident in that BBC debate. For most of the time, he's come across as a kind of relaxed figure. And I think you also see this, which is you can tell he's someone who feels he's got nothing to lose and is enjoying it.
Yes.
While as Theresa May, you can feel as someone who feels that they've got everything to lose. And in a way, you do. When you go into a general election where people expect talking about whether you're going to win by 120 seats or 150 seats, it's almost impossible to win from that position.
And has there been a sort of coming together on the left? Because, I mean, I think there's been a sort of sense that the good old socialism that we thought Corbyn was such a dreadful example of is actually not so bad and not so unpopular.
I mean, there's a big question for the Labour Party post-election is that you can already see this beginning to come out from some of Corbyn's kind of intellectual cheerleaders. This election shows that the right is, the collapse of UKIP means that the right is united. This is why the Tory party is going to get over 40% of the vote for the first time in a general election in a long time. It is because the right is now united behind one party. Corbyn supporters will argue that this means that you need a kind of left unity candidate as Labour leader, someone who can appeal to Greens and left-wing Liberal Democrats, and they will argue that that is the case for him. I can see that case for him, but I also look at the seats that I think Labour are going to lose and the seats that Labour need to win to have a majority, and I don't see how that left unity candidate wins back those seats. You know, there are simply not enough Cambridges and Oxford Easts or Bristols or wherever you want to say for this left unity candidate to,
I
think, win a majority.
What do you mean by left? I mean, there's plainly been an upsurge of support, which there wasn't in the last election, for spending more on public services. There is real concern about the NHS, which is on its knees. Parents very shocked, and I think a lot of candidates have heard outside school gates during this campaign, that the fact that schools are shedding teachers and teaching assistants over these holidays, when they come back in September, there is less money. There will be fewer teachers. I think that genuinely alarms people. I think that's really got through. So that this kind of left-right of the Labour Party is more about the past than about the future. If they can find a candidate who hasn't got the sort of Corbynite, McDonaldite baggage behind them, I think that's a reasonable way of uniting the party. I think it could be done if one could think of the right person.
As someone on the centre-right, two things worry me about this election. One is that if this had been an austerity election rather than a Brexit election, the Tories would have lost. Every time the debate has got on to austerity, the Tories have been on the back foot and have been losing. I also think it's very alarming that we are still in a position, despite the fact however long we've been running a deficit for, that whenever a new problem emerges, the British psyche's answer is for more state. The second thing that worries me about it is the Tory troubles in London. And I think that gives you a preview of what happens to a centre-right party when the number of property owners declines radically. And I think this is one of the big dangers for Toryism in this country. If Britain ceases to be a property-owning democracy, it becomes much harder for the Tories to win.
I think there's no doubt at all that the Tories will lose the next election, because what they have to go through as best they can, and if they do it as skillfully as possible in terms of Brexit and its effects, they'll reap the whirlwind of that. And I cannot see how they're going to come through the other end in 5 years' time with everybody feeling fine. It's just not looking that way. The economy, you know, almost all of the serious economists expect things to be pretty grim in 5 years' time.
There's obviously going to be an adjustment period of Brexit. I think one of the reasons why some Tories are so angry about the campaign is they wanted to win this election by such a big majority that Labour couldn't overturn it in one go. Their dream was that basically an insurance policy, that if you get a majority of 150 seats, in the sheer number of seats that the opposition need to target, it becomes very difficult for them to turf you out in one election. I think the majority won't be the kind of majority that Blair won in 97 or that Thatcher won in 83 that guarantees you win the next election after that.
That was James Forsyth and Polly Toynbee. And James will be blogging throughout the night on Thursday into Friday as the election results come through. So visit www.spectator.co.uk/coffeehouse for up-to-the-minute analysis. And finally, can we all please turn out the lights? In her magazine piece this week, Laura Freeman says that one of the great problems in modern life is that there were never in true darkness. And for that reason, we do not know how to relax. So, Laura, in your piece this week, you say that there is far too much light in our lives and we need more dark. Can you explain what you're going on about?
Yes, I think it's not just street lamps which shine in the bedroom windows at night. It's not just fire escape lights, but we're endlessly surrounded by gadget lights and screen lights and little pilot lights. Every single electrical appliance in my house and every charger seems to have a little blinking thing that goes off all night. And if you're charging a phone by the bed or an electric toothbrush or a razor, you've got all the sort of, you know, sinister little eyes looking at you when you're actually trying to sleep.
Octopus eyes.
Cyclops. Yeah, Cyclops, that's the one. But I think it's probably not very good for us to be constantly stimulated, whether it's by screens or by lights. And I actually think darkness is quite soothing. And the more rare it is, I think the more we should prize it and seek it out and want it.
And you say that actually now you have to sort of almost pay for darkness because it's such a rare commodity.
Well, I was trying to think of the last two occasions when I'd actually experienced true darkness. And they were both sort of experiences. So one, I went under the tunnels in Ramsgate where locals sheltered during the war from the bombs. And the guide at one point turned off his torch and we were plunged into darkness. And it was actually quite thrilling because, you know, I'd not really had anything like that. And that feeling that, you know, there was no chink of light, you couldn't go down the corridor, you'd have had to walk for another 10 minutes to get to natural daylight again. And then the other was an art installation that deliberately makes you sit in the dark for 10 minutes until your eyes are accustomed to it and you see a very, very faint neon tube in the distance. Mm. And actually on both occasions, I found it sort of allowed your mind to just have a little bit of looseness and freedom instead of being always kind of overwrought and sort of lit up.
Yes, we think a lot about noise pollution and that being a sort of general irritant, and also now light pollution, but you're saying that it's also self-imposed because we're constantly looking at blue screens.
Yes.
And they're ruining our sense of peace.
And definitely, and I've got girlfriends who complain that, you know, they've got a boyfriend who works in the city, he'll kind of put his BlackBerry practically on the pillow at night and the messages will flash up and flash up and flash up, and he'll say, well, you know, there's a big deal going through, I've got to be aware of what's going on, and they lie awake while these kind of little blue beams come out or you know, into the small hours. And I think we ought to seek out this sort of gothic gloom and darkness and actually annihilate endless infiltrating light.
So peace of mind is established through darkness, is what you're saying?
Well, I think it might be, and I don't know, I don't want to kind of turn all amateur anthropologist, but I wonder if there's not something sort of primal and atavistic. You know, our ancestors would have known darkness and would have been frightened by it, but would have borne it. And I wonder if we're losing something by not being able to manage in long periods where we can't just switch on a lamp or a torch.
Yes, as a parent, rather pathetically, I always sort of leave a light on for the children somewhere. Do you think we should black them out?
Well, I certainly used to sleep with the door slightly ajar and a light on in the hall when I was younger. But I think maybe as you get a little bit older, you should possibly wean yourself off that. And I would love to sleep in darkness, but actually because I've got a flat in London, there's so much light that comes in from the flats opposite that even when I wake up in the night, I don't have to turn the lamp on to look at my watch. I can just look at it through the blinds and I can still read the clock face.
Hmm. What about wearing those things?
Oh, the silk eye mask. Yeah. You sort of do a sort of diva and go to sleep with one of those on.
Would that work?
I think it would certainly help. But I do think there's something that we should maybe try and be a bit more resilient. So I'm not advocating walking home in the dark, because actually I'm very glad as a woman that you can walk home through streets and, you know, not be in kind of Stygian gloom and be mugged on the way. But I think it would be lovely, the idea that you could go camping, you could say, right, we're not going to have a torch. Once it goes dark, it's dark and we're going to bed and we'll just look up at the stars or whatever it is, and actually experience kind of true darkness without endless electric interference.
Well, at night, I put my phone on orange mode or whatever it is, which is a more soothing light. Do you think we should just switch them off altogether?
Yes.
After 8 o'clock?
Yes, and I think for your peace of mind in all sorts of, you know, life, just turning your phone off is a very good idea. And blackout blinds and eye masks, and as much as you can manage.
I wonder if it isn't the actual sort of interruption of technology and news and information and all that, and it's actually just the effect of the light on the eye.
I think that that could be very well possible, but I think it's just a sort of a combination of factors.
We need to look into the science. That was Laura Freeman. That's all for this week. You can subscribe to the podcast on the iTunes store or by visiting www.spectator.co.uk/podcast. You can also subscribe to our other shows, including our religion podcast, Holy Smoke. And if you enjoy our podcast, why not pick up the magazine? You can read all the features discussed on the podcast, as well as great pieces by Paul Wood, Miriam Gross, Ross Clark, and many others. We have a special offer for podcast listeners, 12 issues for £12, and a limited edition of a Spectator moleskin notebook, if you subscribe at spectator.co.uk/podoffer. Thanks for listening, and do join us again next week.